Thanks for opening up the toolkit. I'm your host, Justin Fortier. Today, we're talking about investment banking. Now, there's a lot about investment banking on the internet. I'm sure if you go to YouTube, there are countless lectures from universities or recruiting videos from firms like Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan. But today, I'm going to talk with Doug Levette, who's from Third Coast Capital Advisors, which does things a little bit differently and has a different focus from the typical mergers and acquisitions, M&A for short, investment bank. Most firms are focused on helping companies sell, but very few are focused on helping people buy. Doug's firm, Third Coast Capital Advisors, is focused on helping companies and private equity firms research and identify companies to buy, and then they specialize in reaching out with them, getting them interested in starting a deal, and guiding the companies or firms through that process smoothly. Now, companies represent a lot to a lot of people. They're certainly worth a lot of money. In many respects, they represent somebody's life's work. So it's really interesting to talk with somebody who's done this hundreds of times and who has a firm that is really focused on guiding people through this important, high tension, high stakes process. So whether you're focused on advising companies, building your own, buying a business, or working for any of the firms that do all three, I think this is a great episode for you. And even if you're not one of those three, I think you'll take away some lessons about sales and maintaining relationships in a business context. So without further ado, my interview with Doug Levette of Third Coast Capital Advisors. Before Third Coast, you were working at Bank of America, helping middle market companies. Did you develop the buy side thesis while you were working there? Were you supporting both sell side and buy side engagements, or how'd you see this niche that needed to be served?
That's a great question, Justin. I was doing traditional sell side work. So we were primarily working with clients of the bank who would come to the decision that they wanted to sell their business, and they'd hire us and we'd run a formal sale process, which is pretty typical out in the market. And we did that, you know, for a long time, and that was our main activity. But we were asked fairly often by the commercial bankers at Bank of America. They had large clients that were important customers of the bank that wanted to pursue strategic acquisitions, and they were looking for assistance. So those bankers would come to us and ask if we could help, and we just weren't set up to do buy side. It's a different activity. It's a different process, different resources required. We always said no, but over the course of time, it became clear that there was a real need there. And that it was, as we looked around in the market, it was being underserved. And we decided, I left with a couple of guys in August of 2008, right before the economy was ready to go off the cliff. And we formed Third Coast Capital Advisors. And we looked at how buy side was being done at the time. And we said, let's see if we can come up with a better model. And really the better model was, we felt if we took a lot of the formality and organization that we used on the sell side, and if we applied that to the buy side, that we could be much more efficient at doing that work. And I think that was always the challenge with buy side, is the outcome was unpredictable, and you were, and there just wasn't a lot of process around it. And that's what we did. So we, you know, hung our shingle back in August of 2008, and with the sole intent of doing buy side, and really initially what we were calling outsourced corporate development. We were initially going after larger private and public companies who didn't have dedicated M&A people on staff. And we said, look, we'll do that for you. And we'll both identify and reach out to and help evaluate and execute strategic acquisitions for the company. But that's really how and why it started.
Yeah, so I have two questions. I think I'll start with just the why traditional sell side M&A bankers are not set up to run a process like this. I'm not a banker. I only interned for a small technology investment bank up in Boston for one semester during college. But from there, I understood there's always a deadline, or there's a firm commitment where a company says, I want to sell, we've made the decision to sell. So even though there's risk in taking on a client, because maybe they'll decide that all the companies you bring to sell or sell them to are not suitable, and they may back out, there's a much higher likelihood that they'll actually go through, whereas the buy side is a little bit more nebulous and may take longer, and that's a little more difficult. Is that kind of summing up why these banks typically don't take buy-side engagements?
Yeah, that's certainly a big part of it. I think, as you noted, on the sell side, if you are engaged by an attractive client, there's in the market then and in the market today, there's more buyers than sellers and there's more money than deals. So if you have an attractive company representing for sale, you're going to get a lot of interest. And while you put a lot of time and hours and manpower into it, the likely result is you're going to get a deal closed. The outcome on the buy side is much more unpredictable because really at the end of the day, we are reaching out to business owners that own companies that, and they're not for sale. They're not actively looking to sell. In many cases, not even thinking of selling. But you can imagine the outcome is very unpredictable with that kind of outreach. But we felt like if we could create a process and approach that was very repeatable, that was streamlined, that was efficient, and if we were doing all the outreach, which we do with very senior, experienced people that had long backgrounds in something M&A related, investment banking, private equity, corporate development, that we could be successful and we could be efficient in doing that. And really, it did take a couple of years. It's not rocket science, but it took a couple of years to continue to fine tune the approach and the process to try to come up with something that would increase the probability of success. And so I would say now we've been at it 14 years, probably the last 10 years, we've had a fairly set process we used. It's very rigorous, it's very tight, and we found a way to be successful in something that otherwise can be challenging.
I was listening to talk that Wharton had posted where they had a bunch of panelists talking about acquisitions. And one thing about corporate development, I think it was somebody from Intuit who they do a large number of acquisitions. And he was saying that it was a skill. And from what I understand, there are both two parts of corporate development. There's the strategy of what types of companies do we want to acquire? How are we going to augment our company or use it for growth? And then on the other side, there's the actual going out, finding and closing the deal in an effective way. These firms that don't have corporate development that are using Third Coast as outsourced corporate development, are they usually coming to you with a strategy, or did you have to develop a process to help them say, when they say we have cash to spend, we think we want to spend this, did you have to learn how to coach them about what even would make sense, and how much of that strategy part is your firm involved in?
Yeah, if it's a corporate type client, the strategy piece is critical. I think when we started out, we just assumed the corporate strategy would be very clearly defined. The acquisition strategy would be clearly defined. And we found that was typically not the case. It was companies that said, hey, we decided that part of our strategy is to grow through acquisition. There's a number of different ways we could go about it. We have different core competencies, different, you know, products, end markets, capabilities, but we just really don't know which would be the most productive to pursue. We did over time. So for some, it was just fine tuning the strategy. For others, it was fully developing the strategy. And so early on, we found ourselves becoming more of a consultant and starting out with a project where we said, okay, we're going to do an acquisition development or strategy development project. And we created a system for doing that. We would interview the top executives at the company. We would lead a strategy session, full day strategy session at the company. And we would come out of that saying, okay, we've got a clearly defined acquisition strategy. And then we would go back and do our traditional work of researching, identifying companies that exist in the market that would be a good fit with the strategy. The other thing with the corporates, and we knew this from the beginning, is that it wasn't just acquisition search, it was acquisition search and advisory. Not only did they need us to help with the strategy, to identify the companies, to do the outreach, to find an owner that said, okay, I'm willing to talk, you know, about a potential sale, but they also needed us to help them work all the way through the process. So we would help them with the valuation for the business, with transaction structure, with the negotiating strategy, all the way through helping them manage due diligence, the letter of intent and closing. So we were really intimately involved in both the strategy, the outreach and the execution.
And do that strategy session, move forward. I'm sure there are some times when you have a strategy developed and then you go out to outreach. And either when they start to see their first companies that you're showing, maybe they change. And I know that probably takes a lot more work for your firm to adapt to that change. Are there any themes that you see or elements you added to your process that helped reduce the amount of waffling? I don't know if that's the right word, but going back and forth when you've worked with these clients.
Yeah, that was a bit of a learning process too. So early on, if we found a willing seller and we collected all the information and we were presenting it to the client, and oftentimes our main contact was the CEO of the business. And these are anywhere from a couple hundred million in revenue to several billion in revenue companies. So very successful, very, you know, accomplished CEOs and CFOs at these companies. And so we just naturally assumed, okay, if we came to them with all the information, all the facts, they'd know exactly what to do next. But we realized pretty quickly that while they want to appear that they know what to do next, many of them don't have an M&A background and they really didn't know what they should be doing next. So early on, we figured out we really need to be proactive and assertive in suggesting, okay, here's all the information. Here's our view. Here's our recommendation. Here's the next step. Here's what we should do. Even to the point of we've run the models. Here's what we think that this is the price we should go in at. This is how it should be structured. And we found pretty quickly that instead of getting pushback, they said, yeah, that makes sense. That's great. I think they were relieved that somebody who had the appropriate background and was guiding them down the path. Once we figured that out, we were able to smooth out what you were suggesting, the waffling or changing of a view or strategy or cherry picking or being overly selective, all those kinds of things. As long as we realized that it's not just, you initially go into it, you think we just have to manage that business owner, meaning we have to hold their hand, warm them up, try to get them intrigued about a potential sale, or try to keep them walking down the path. Well, we also learned pretty quickly, you have to manage the target business owner, but you also have to manage the client and you have to manage the process. And each of those pieces are equally important.
Yeah, that makes quite a bit of sense. And when you're setting up this strategy, how much is your team already looking at what exists out there to buy? Is that part of the research before you even develop a strategy? Because I feel like it could be difficult if you work out like this is the type of business we want, and then there's three of them. One of them's owned by another conglomerate or something, and one of them's a family-owned business, and they've got, I don't know, like four generations on their family page, and it's clearly important to them. And then you get them excited, your client excited about the strategy, but there's really not anything to deliver on that. So how do you go about that assessment process?
No, that's a really insightful question because I don't think people always think about that. They think more in terms, if this company wants to make acquisitions, they must have already determined that it's fragmented and there's a lot of options out there. But in fact, that isn't the case. And from the beginning until today, we've always taken the same approach. And we say to potential clients, prospective clients who say, hey, boy, we referred to you or we just met you. We've talked to you. It sounds great. We want to move forward. We like to do pre-work before we get into something. And we say, so give us a little bit of time to do some research on our side, to really look at the target landscape and really get a better sense for what's out there. If it happens to be an industry sector that maybe we haven't done any recent work in. And we tell them, look, that's for the benefit of both of us. We want to succeed. We want to succeed for you. And to your point, if there's only five companies out there that make sense for you to buy, you really don't need us. But our experience suggests that if there's 30 or more, preferably 60, 80, 100 that could make sense, then we're going to have a highly productive engagement. And they understand. In fact, they appreciate it. Instead of firms saying, oh, they want to hire us, let's just grab it and hope it works. We take a very insightful professional approach and say, look, we're going to take some time up front. That's on our time. And we're going to come back to you and tell you what we found out. And so then we're both going into it with eyes open. We're both going into it with realistic expectations. And we've certainly had some cases in the past where we did that pre-work and determined that there wasn't a lot of targets that were fitting the specific acquisition strategy of the client. And we told them, we don't think it makes sense collectively for all of us to be engaged here. And I think they appreciate that, you know, there was a good amount of work done before we reached that conclusion.
And this podcast is called The Toolkit because I wanted to talk about the tools, but then I realized that most of the tools that I wanted to discuss were the skills or ideas or concepts. But I know you're not doing probably this earliest level of research because you have a team before you, but does that process start with some of the tools like company databases like PitchBook and Capital IQ? Are there any other types of things that either your firm's developed over the years or other things that you found fruitful in assessing companies like this stage?
Yeah, no, we, over the years, I always say the process, which is, you know, predominantly focused on target identification and then collecting as much data as you can on all the targets you've identified. But it's really an art and a science. The science piece are the databases that you subscribe to. So in that regard, we determined that the research and the target identification is so critical to what we do that we don't want to shortcut that piece. So we invest an extraordinary amount of money across a number of databases in order to have all the best information available. So we use Grata, we use SourceScrub, we use ZoomInfo, and we use Capital IQ. But then that's just giving you a lot of raw data, right? It's giving you a lot of companies that at a high level appear to fit of a specific acquisition strategy. But then it takes a lot of additional filtering and scrubbing to really work from that broader list down to companies that truly fit. We have a really rigorous and robust research process, which it has to be critical because when we present a final target list to a client, we want them to say 99% of those names, yeah, I totally get it. Those are a good fit. And the 1% that don't fit, we just want it to be, that's a fit, but I know the owner, or we've had a bad experience with them, and we don't want to buy that company. We have two younger guys, super sharp guys that are 100% focused on research. And that kind of shows you how critical it is not only use those databases, but to then continue to filter and scrub to get to a good list.
When you're presenting this list, it sounds like you are focused on presenting only hits, or you said 99%. Is that something you learned over time, that it only makes sense to show what exactly fits the strategy, and presenting more companies is a distraction or confusion? Was that always how the process was, or is that something you learned?
No, I would say that evolved over time too. Originally, we would do the work years ago to put together a target list, and we'd cast a fairly wide net. And in some cases, I think we probably were cutting corners saying, we had less people then, we were probably cutting corners saying, this looks pretty good. Let's just put it in front of the client. Let's have them go through it because they know better than we do what they really like. But the problem with that is I think it was a frustration for the clients because that meant that they had to put a lot of time into it. Because if they looked at a target, it didn't really fit, then they say, boy, I really got to check every single one of these and make sure it's a fit. And again, pretty early on, we said, okay, accuracy in identifying targets is critical. But then we said, but it's a balance, right? You do want to cast a bit of a wide net because it's easier to take a broader list and reduce it than it is to have a narrow list and wonder what you missed. For the last few years, and I'd say over time, our business has really evolved. In the early years, it was heavy corporate with a little bit of private equity work. In the last 5 years, it's completely flipped. We're probably, you know, 80, 90% doing strategic add-on work for portfolio companies that are owned by private equity firms. And we can talk about what led to that trend, and it was really a market trend. But that audience in particular, that private equity audience and the management teams, their portfolio company, are very aware, obviously very sophisticated as it relates to what's a fit and what's not a fit. That really forced over the last 5 years, we had to be even more accurate than we've been before. And the way we addressed the situation where we said, okay, we don't want to inadvertently exclude something that might be a fit because there's still going to be overlapping products, overlapping markets. We're only going to put something on there that we can comfortably argue it's a fit and here's why. But by the same token, there could be many of these businesses, there's something about them. They might be doing something else, serving another market, a different capability, a different geography that someone could argue, okay, that's not really a fit. We've started tiering the lists. And in the early days, we'd have the client tier the list. For the most part, we'll initially tier it and then have them confirm our tiering, meaning we'll say, okay, tier one, these are the ones we identified. They seem to check all the boxes. We really think this is a fit. Tier two is we also think is a fit, but these are companies that are also doing something adjacent that we still think we should make a phone call to and talk to those owners because we may find that the mix in their business is either more towards what we're looking for, or it's away from what we're looking for. And then that would really, what the level of interest would be. Mm-hmm. So we do a tiering now, and then we present it to the client, and we ask them to evaluate our tiering. And ultimately, it's a simple 1, 2, 3. 1, in the bullseye, looks like it's a really good fit. That's going to be the first wave of outreach calls. Two, again, it's a potential fit. It looks like it could be attractive, but that's going to be the second wave of calls. And three is just that category I mentioned earlier, where the management team may happen to know the company or the owner, and there's just, they know they don't like them, or it's not a fit for some other reason. And so they'll knock it off the list.
It seems like there has been a trend from what you've said so far about more and more handholding, more assertion from your side as you've gotten more confident about the process to guide, which takes more work off the plate. You talked about the business shifting quite a bit from corporates to private equity. Was that the corporate business basically stayed the same in total number of deals for you, and the private equity business just really took off because of the increase in private equity funding and the sophistication and maybe the amount of capital these companies have? So they're really looking for advisors to help them speed up or do, you were saying, I think roll up, I don't know if you use that word, but where they've acquired a company and one of the services they offer is helping that management team grow quickly through acquisition, or are corporates actually declining as a part of your business?
Yeah, no, great question. I think it's a two-pronged answer. First, really, corporates are as acquisitive as they've ever been. So that piece hasn't changed at all. I think what's changed is that the overriding trend in the market for the private equity firms that everybody's been seeing for a few years now. Look, it's always been competitive, but in the last few years in particular, as the market's been stronger, these sell-side auctions are becoming much more competitive for quality companies. So ultimately what happens is whoever's going to, win that auction is likely paying a very high price, a premium price. And often organic growth alone isn't going to provide the return they need based on the amount of equity they're investing in that platform company. So now, whereas add-on acquisitions, in some cases for private equity firms, were more of a luxury, over the last few years, it's become an absolute necessity. They really need to do add-on acquisitions at lower multiples in order to get the return that they're looking for. So the thesis has changed where add-ons have become a lot more important. And with that, I think a lot of these private equity firms, look, all the traditional buy and build firms, many of them were already using buy-side firms like us because that was their investment style. But the rest of the private equity market, that would only selectively pursue add-on acquisitions for certain portfolio companies, now said, look, that's got to be a part of the growth plan. And so they said, we don't want to distract management. We don't want them doing the outreach when we've already put an aggressive organic plan in front of them. We need to get some help. So they started popping their heads up. Well, we've been hearing about these buy-side firms out there. Maybe we should talk to some of them. And that was the market shift that really ramped up the private equity side of our business. And over the last, few years, as we, like anything, if you get an engagement with a private equity firm and you do a great job, they say, oh, I've got this other portfolio company over here. I want you to do some add-on work there. And oh, by the way, we're pursuing a new company in a competitive process. We think we're going to win it. We want to engage you there as soon as we close on that. The corporate business was really a referral business. It was really their commercial banker or their accountant, their attorney would reach out to us and say, hey, I've got a company, they're interested in acquisitions, I want to introduce you. The private equity side, we could actually proactively call on these groups and say, hey, you may not know who we are. Here's how we do business. Here's how we're different. Here's clients we've worked with in the past. And we hired a business development person and we really started getting in front of, this is probably starting 4 years ago, getting in front of a lot of private equity groups. And then it really just built out from there.
When you're reaching out to the target businesses, if it has a private equity owner already, that's your point of contact. I heard you mention calling CEOs before. I think that was maybe in your clients were the CEOs context. But is that the people you're typically working with? You don't reach out to one of their portfolio companies?
I'll answer it two ways. So in terms of prospective clients, we're reaching out to the private equity groups in terms of just introducing the firm if they don't know us already. And this really goes back 4 or 5 years. And then they'd say, okay, great, sounds great. And we were always differentiated because our model from the beginning was we feel the way to be most successful in executing on add-on acquisitions is to do it with very experienced senior people. So we're very top heavy as a firm, and with a number of managing director level people, And it's that level that does all the outreach to targets and really all the client service work, because that increases the probability of success. When you're a 30-year investment banker reaching out to someone in the same peer group, age group, you know, there's a maturity level there that connects well with those business owners. And we feel that that helps create success. But at the, so at the target company level, we're always trying to reach out to the owner of the business. We want to get to the decision maker, the owner. That's who we want to connect with. On a sort of marketing business development basis, we're always calling on the private equity firms, because obviously then they're going to say, okay, we're going to introduce you to the management team of this particular company. You've convinced us that you'd be a great fit for this, but we don't want to just force this decision on the management team. So we also want you to talk with them as well and make sure that they're comfortable with engaging you here. So it's a two-step marketing process.
You said you're top heavy. Are most of those senior people all coming from investment banking background? And are they more generalists, or do you hire specific sector focus? What have you found works best for this type of work?
Yeah, no, as a firm, we're intentionally generalists, mainly because we feel like it's the quality of our process, the quality of our people, you know, the approach, and we feel like it can be universally applied to the vast majority of industry sectors out there. If something is, and there's, it's the minority that are really nuanced, and if we don't have direct experience, we'll be the first to say, hey, we're not a great fit for this. But the vast majority of the industries out there, we've either done some work in, or we can come up to speed pretty quickly. So the background of the people, it's a bit of a variety, but it's all M&A related. The senior people got 25 years in investment banking. I've got a couple of colleagues with very similar investment banking backgrounds. We've got corporate development backgrounds. We've got management consulting and leverage finance. So we've covered everything that every angle of a typical M&A transaction is, and that is the right background. Because even with the private equity, we still need to be in a position where we're still playing an advisory role, even if it's providing a second opinion about valuation or structure or strategy. That's still a critical part to our value add and how we try to differentiate ourselves from the other firms, you know, that are doing buy side out there.
I'm sure this is something that investment bankers learn over a long career about how to reach out to targets. Well, especially in your buy side case, when you've identified a business that looks good on paper that your client may like to acquire, but reaching out to businesses, the private equity owners are probably more likely to talk to you because they're in the business of buying and selling companies. But getting the attention of a family owned business and communicate with them or get them excited about something, are there any types of skills or tactics that younger people coming up could learn about communication? Have you ever had experiences where somebody said, no, we're not interested, and you found a way to convince them or contact them or get the idea in front of them enough in order to have them say, okay, yeah, we'll take a look?
Yeah, sure. First, the vast majority of the companies we're calling are privately owned, and we're able through our databases to determine if a company's privately owned, a target versus owned by a private equity firm. Some of our clients, private equity clients, say, hey, you don't need to call the ones that are owned by private equity because we know it's going to be all about price and it's unlikely we're going to get a deal done. But some are open to that. But really the idea is to try to find the privately owned companies, target companies. Yeah, and with them, it's very nuanced to your point. First and foremost, you've got to make them feel special, and you have to make them feel like they're not part of just some shotgun approach, that instead it's they were specifically selected for very specific strategic reasons. We have to make sure before every outreach call we make that it's very customized and that we've looked at the information about that target company we're going to reach out to, that we've looked at their website, that we've thought through what the strategic fit and rationale is, because you only have a short window. You know, if you're talking to that owner, you have a very short window to establish credibility where they say, okay, I get these goofy calls all the time. Somebody wants to buy my business, but no, this is different. This one seems genuine. It seems credible. They've spent the time to look at my business. And so we articulate very clearly the strategic fit. You know, in other words, why is our client interested? And the ultimate goal is they would hear what we say and go, wow, I get it. I completely understand why they want to buy me. It's a good fit. And so the real key is to not make that conversation or the transaction about money. Because they're not for sale. So their natural inclination is to fall back. If you give me a crazy price, I'll sell you my business. No, we want to first, if there's some interest, we want to first say, hey, let's put price and money to the side for a minute. We ask you just to accept that our client is willing to pay a fair market price for a good business. So before we get there, let's just first figure out, is the strategic fit what we believe it to be? Is there a good cultural fit? Is there good chemistry across the principals? And we say, because if we don't have those pieces, price is irrelevant and we're all wasting our time. And so they say, yeah, that makes sense. And it's a more comfortable way to evaluate a fit and a more comfortable way to maintain a dialogue. And so that's the real strategy, is to try to really connect on strategy and culture before you ever talk about price.
Culture is something I'm still early in my career, so I'm always trying to get a sense of how you can assess that in the early stages. If you have any sort of short answer, I'm sure it's pretty difficult, but that's something I'm really curious about, how one assesses that just quickly. And a lot of companies' websites start to look the same. They might have similar values posted, but how can you determine what's really important to that owner? And if your client values the same thing, especially when private equity sometimes has a strategy of cost reduction, sometimes it's about growth, but yeah. Do you have anything to speak to that?
Yeah, you're right. It's difficult through a conversation to assess culture, but we ask early on when we're talking to a business owner, what elements of a transaction are very important to you beyond price? So then you're going to start to hear things like, oh, I want to take care of my management team, or I want to take care of my employees, or I want to make sure we maintain this facility in this particular town. So you start to hear some of the things from the target side that are important. And then ultimately, after we have our initial conversation with the prospective or with the target company, and they're interested and willing in continuing the dialogue, we download all that information that we've obtained on that call to our client. And we say, hey, we think this is pretty interesting. We think it's a good fit. Let's move to an introductory call. And so it's on that call that you first get a sense for culture and chemistry, because we're going to bring the CEO of our client onto that call. The business owner is going to come onto the call. Now, obviously, the last couple of years, we're able to use Zoom or Teams, so at least they're seeing each other. But you start through that conversation, that initial call. It's a higher level. It's a little bit of a get to know you. It starts with our client giving kind of a quick history on the business, where they focus, what's important to them. And then we flip it over to the target to do the same. I think our clients' culture is important to our clients just as much as culture is important to the target company. I think it's through that initial dialogue, you start to hear what's important, how they manage their businesses. And that's early on the best way to get to culture. And ultimately, if you keep moving through the process, there's going to be a point where there's a face-to-face meeting. And sometimes, most often, it's at the target company's business location, but sometimes our clients say, hey, we want to first invite them in to our facility so they can get a feel firsthand for our people, our culture, our operations.
I was listening to a woman who runs she calls it a private equity firms focused on boring businesses. And some of these privately held family owned companies that she's trying to reach out to don't have a ton of information out there. And she was saying that she's used a whole bunch of different tactics, calling being the first one. Email, sending letters sometimes. Are there any things that you found effective to get that first meeting so you can actually get the appointment set up where you can have everybody come together and really discuss what the opportunity could be? How much work have you done beforehand?
Yeah, we've never been a big fan of mailing a letter or sending a FedEx, things like that. More just sort of traditional. We always start with a call. Quite often you may get in the owner's voicemail, which is fine. At least you're speaking to them directly when you leave the voicemail. We immediately follow up with an email, but it's a very descriptive email. We always say, you know, who we're calling on behalf of, you know, what's our client's name, a link to their website. Sometimes we have a short overview presentation about our client, but we're fairly direct about why we're calling, but it's through that voicemail and through that email that we really need to be articulate in explaining the fit, why we're reaching out, and just demonstrating some knowledge so they say, okay, this is credible. Most often they're going to respond by replying to the email as opposed to calling you back, which is fine. It's easier to respond to the email to set up a call and then go from there. So it's call, email, call, email, call, email till you can, you know, make a connection.
I've found that I've often underestimated the amount of work that it actually requires to get something done. Working versus school. School is very easy to estimate how long something was going to get done. Do you find that the number of companies you start with, I think you said 30, 60, whatever that list may be of a complete but strong target universe or whatever you want to call it, is that something where the total number of companies you started with has to get whittled down at a certain point so people can tell that you're serious? When you start making these introductory calls, is there a number or is it more of a feeling of these are the right people to move forward? Because if you're trying to be sincere to 15, I feel like that would be difficult.
Yeah. Now, up front, obviously, there's a lot of vetting around the list, but whatever the ultimate approved list is, where the client said, okay, we approve that you reach out to these business owners, we've tracked two statistics in process. One is just the initial penetration. In other words, what percent of the business owners on the approved list are we able to actually talk to? We got through, they responded in some fashion. And over the course of the engagement, we really like to get that to at least to 70. The other 30%, there's just some companies, no matter how many times you reach out, they're just not going to respond. They're not interested. They choose not to respond. And that's fine. That's just the way it is. That 70% penetration, that doesn't mean they say, yeah, we're interested in talking about a sale. It just means we've talked to them and they've said, hey, we're not ready. Or thanks for reaching out. Call me in 2 years, whatever the answer is. The other stat we look at is what percentage of that initial approved list, what percentage were actually willing and interested in discussing a potential transaction. That typically, you know, it varies a little, but not a whole lot. That tends to be 15 to 20% of companies are saying, okay, this is interesting. I'm intrigued enough to have a dialogue. And those things stay fairly steady across most of our engagements. But the real key to what we do, ultimately success, and to a great extent, hinges on our ability to very quickly connect and develop a rapport with that business owner, that target business owner. Because if we can get them comfortable with us, then they're going to put their guard down a little bit. They're going to open up in providing information and answers to our questions. But more importantly, they're going to open their mind to exploring the possibility of combining their company with our client. So that gets back to the value of having a more, you know, experienced, mature person doing the outreach, because just through the course of time and experience, I think we're in a good position to try to develop a rapport with that owner. Ultimately, we don't want them to see us as, oh, they're representing the buyer, they're going to try to screw me. We want them to look at us as, hey, this is what these guys do every day for a living. View us more as a facilitator, because it takes two sides to make it work. So we say, look, we're just trying to figure out if this is a good fit both ways, and let's explore it together and figure it out. And then ultimately, because they're comfortable with us, they'll ask us maybe the dumb questions that they're reluctant to ask our client directly because they don't want to look bad. And so we'll, depending on their level of sophistication, we'll talk about things to think about. We'll talk about add backs to their numbers. We'll talk about, you know, how the transaction comes together. We'll talk about how companies are valued, all those things. Ultimately, we want them to feel comfortable with us. And if you get that comfortable rapport, it really changes the whole dynamic of the conversation.
Well, thank you so much, Doug. This has been insightful. I'm definitely going to send this to anybody who's interested in private equity or buy-side banking for that matter. So thank you very much.
Yeah, great talking with you, Justin.
Well, thank you for listening. If you made it this far, I know you're somebody I get along with. So if you want to reach out and chat a little bit or give some feedback on the show or new suggestions, my email is justin@toolkit.fm, or you could reach out to me on Twitter at Justin P. Fortier. That's Fortier, Justin P. Fortier. And if you really liked it, share it with a friend. Hope this helps. Until next time.